Hey, Kale here. Quick reminder that this episode deals with spoilers for the 1992 film Dracula by Francis Ford Coppola, and of course the comic. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Matt and Caleb Read Comics. I'm Matt Smith. I'm a Canadian cartoonist and comics educator currently living in Scotland.
And I'm Kale Werke. I'm a longtime mainstream comic book fan, cosplayer, collector, and former filmmaker.
Every episode, Kale and I are going to look at a different graphic novel. We have high hopes of covering a wide range of different books. Last episode, our first episode, was Watchmen, the classic Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons, 1985 classic graphic novel. We had a really lovely response from my friends, from your friends. It was really nice people reaching out to us and just saying how much they enjoyed the episode. I have a friend named Jake. I know you have a friend named Jake who also said some really nice things, but my Jake friend just said there was many times when he was listening where he wanted to yell out and join in the conversation and add in more information. And then I asked him, I was like, what did we miss? Tell us what we missed. And he's like, I can't remember now. So if you're listening, Jake, and anyone else who's listening during this episode and you want to add to the conversation, you know, make a note or just write to us on Facebook or on Instagram and join the conversation. We'd love to hear anything we might have missed.
And please feel free to yell out random things while you're listening to our podcast like a crazy person at any time.
Yes, that's the best way to listen to podcasts. Just put your headphones on and join in the conversation as if you were with us.
Exactly.
This episode, today's episode, this week's episode, we're looking at the adaptation of the film Bram Stoker's Dracula. So it's an adaptation of a film, which is an adaptation of a novel. We usually say, you know, spoilers, we are going to tell you what happens in both the comic and the film that it's adapted from. But in this case, I feel we're pretty safe. If you don't, maybe if you haven't read this specific Dracula comic, you probably know the story pretty well. There's Count Dracula from Transylvania comes to London and terrorizes Mina and her friends and family. And, you know, it's a pretty well-known story, but it's interesting that we're doing this adaptation of a film. I normally wouldn't want to do a comic that's a film adaptation. I think, you know, with maybe good reason, there's not tons that are really very strong works of art on their own. And also, I'm a bit of a purist. You know, Kale and I both have a film background. We met in film school many years ago. And I kind of like, you know, if this story is best told as a film, then let it be a film. Or if this story is best told as a comic, let it stay a comic. But I hadn't even heard this book until a couple of weeks ago. I have a comics app from my local library here in Scotland, and this Bram Stoker's Dracula popped up. And I've always enjoyed the film, but the art is by Mike Mignola, and it's just incredible. And the art was just so amazing that I said to Kayla, we were trying to find something for October, you know, something kind of horror Halloween themed. And it's like, dude, we got to do this book, and you got to check it out.
Yeah, the spooky Halloween edition of our show. And something interesting about this book actually is that it was created before Hellboy. So Mike Mignola's art is like, you know, he's just getting started as an artist, and it's very well done. It's beautifully adapted. And another, like, when I was thinking about it, the fact that like they adapted a film, and you know, usually you're used to a film being an adaptation of a comic book, right? Or, you know,
yeah,
in this case, it's being like, it's an adaptation of a book that became a film. And from that film, it was adapted into a comic. So it's a very, very interesting comic to read.
Yeah. I do want to say off the top, just to give credit where credit is due, this adaptation was written by Roy Thomas with pencils by Mike Mignola, who is in his pre-Hellboy phase of his career, like you said. Mm-hmm. Inks by John Nyberg. Colors by Mark Torello with letters by John Costanza. And of course, it's based on the Francis Ford Coppola film. What's your history with the film, Gail? Just, you know, before we get into the comic specifically.
Okay, so I've seen it on cable TV since like the 90s. I've seen it too many times to count.
Edited?
Well, edited and not edited. I mean, when my parents could afford HBO, you know, it would come on once in a while and I would check it out. But I actually was a fan of the book. You know, my sister took this this writing class in college, and she got this like book of vampire stories, and I still have it to this day. And it has Bram Stoker's Dracula in it, in this whole like compendium. So I was a fan of the story, the original story, and then I saw the movie, and then of course I saw all the spoofs, you know, like Dracula Dead and Loving It, amazing adaptation of Dracula there. But what I loved about this movie is that how visual it is, right? Like, yes. I mean, I just love the art direction in this movie. It's like mm-hmm. so beautiful, you know, and you can tell that they put a lot of effort into it.
Visually very sumptuous. It's very theatrical. There's a lot of yeah. practical effects and lots of in-camera transitions and in-camera special effects, mm-hmm. which just adds to that sort of theatricalness of the film.
Yeah. How Francis Ford Coppola used shadows in the movie.
Mm-hmm. And you said shadows. I got lots of notes about shadows in this comic.
Right? Yeah. And they use it in the comic as well. It's super interesting.
Yeah.
The opening shot of like the Turks and, you know, the battles that Vlad goes through and the mm-hmm. armor he's wearing, his yes. like demon-like armor. It's so, so theatrical. But yeah, I guess we could just, what are your thoughts on that? Like the opening sequence of the book and the movie?
Yeah, I really like the opening. It's very comic booky in the opening of the film because it is very much a silhouette. And that's a very comic book sort of arts choice. And the comic does it itself. You know, it's just black silhouettes. I'm looking mm-hmm. at the first page of art. There's just a little bit of light on Vlad's fingers as he holds the staff where he's like stabbing through one of the invading forces, mm-hmm. just a little bit of color. But in the movie, it's almost like a shadow play at the beginning. And it's very kind of cool to use these all black silhouettes in comics. You see it quite often. You know, it's a way of just kind of making the individual panels pop a bit more. So it's cool that the film itself kind of starts with something that's very comic booky. Mm-hmm. My history really quick with the film, I saw it when I was, not when it first came out, when I was a little bit older, but my house where I grew up, one of the houses when I grew up in Malaysia, the top floor was just one long room. So we had the TV and the couches in one end and then like our musical instruments in the middle. And I remember watching it once and my dad was doing work on the family desktop at the far end. And guess what scene came on, Kale?
Would it be the werewolf basically having sex with Lucy?
No, it's much earlier than that. It's the scene where Jonathan is being seduced by the three vampire brides. So there's three vampire brides and there's, you know, a tasteful amount of nudity. But yeah, my dad was on the other side of the room. And I didn't want to abruptly turn the movie off. So I just kind of waited for everything to be over. But, you know.
Did he say, son, please don't get up?
He said nothing, which I don't know if he noticed and was just polite enough not to say anything, but we've never spoken of this, so I wonder if he'll bring it up now. But yeah, so this film was an adaptation. It was originally published by Topps, so you know the old trading card company. They got into comics for a while, and then it fell out of print for like almost 25 years, almost a quarter century. It's crazy. 2.5 decades it was out of print, and then they reprinted it. I think at first I've gotten kind of mixed notes, but I feel like they brought it back into print at first in black and white, and then more recently they restored the full color. So I think it was color originally, went out of print, reprinted black and white, and now it's full color. And I'm glad that I found the full color one because I got some notes on the color, and I just think that there's so much lovely stuff being done with color here, just like in most of Mignola's work.
I actually checked out the black and white version, and for some reason I like it more than the color version, just because it seems more gothic. When I look at the color version, I actually rewatched the movie after I read the comic yesterday, and just to refresh my memory, and it seems more like a straight adaptation when you look at the comic, the color comic and the movie. But if I go to the black and white version, it seems more like a just a more gothic, like original take. You know, it's a little bit different.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and feel.
Yeah, well, I think it is interesting to how closely it does stick to the film. And, you know, I've read interviews with Roy Thomas, the writer, saying that he, you know, obviously was a bit constrained and had to follow what the film was being done. But I didn't have time to watch the entire film again, but I was just watching some scenes just now. And I mean, he's very open about it. And he says, like, I've taken all the dialogue is taken from the film. So obviously you have to make some cuts and some changes, but pretty much all the printed words come from the script. And I think it's really interesting that Roy Thomas has gone on record and said that thanks primarily to the art of Mike Mignola, the comic book is better than the film. And I just love that he's just, he's calling his shot. He's like, you know what? This is better. And it's bold, but you know what? I really enjoy this. And I do want to watch the film again. Having seen the film recently after just reading this book, you know, how would you compare them or how would you rank them out of the two?
Yeah, so I actually like the comic book better. I feel like they handled the dialogue better, actually, because there is a difference in the dialogue. I was doing direct comparisons like between the dialogue in the comic book and the movie just because I was just curious to see if they were going to follow through with it just the way I kind of read it, right? So, yeah, they took some liberties with it, and that was good. Maybe they were working off of an earlier adaptation of the script. So maybe that's why the dialogue is a little different, but I actually like it.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I impressed upon you that we have to read this and you have to read this, even if we don't end up using it as an episode of our show, is just the art is just fantastic. And like I said, you know, usually with adaptations, you don't necessarily want anything that's too unique or too stylistic. You kind of want to replicate the experience of, you know, watching the film. And Roy Thomas has even said that in some interviews that I read, that he wants it to be exactly the same as if you were watching the movie, just now it's printed on paper. But I just think it's funny that he said that, but he chose, or maybe it wasn't chosen for him, maybe Topps assigned the artist, but he went with such a visually distinct artist. And I think it just creates a different experience because the art is just so visually distinctive and so unique that it's not just like watching, you know, screenshots of Coppola's film. And it's just funny that his goal as the writer was to recreate the experience. But I think you and I both are kind of agreeing that they've outdone it. And he agrees too that he's outdone it in large part because of the art. So I want to talk about, you know, the difference between film and comics. As I said, you know, you and I both have a background in filmmaking. I am now a cartoonist. And there are differences. I know that a lot of times people say, oh, comics are just like, you know, frozen movies on the page. But there are differences and there are things that work, I think, better in each medium. And it's interesting, some of the things that I think they tried to adapt really faithfully don't quite work in this adaptation. I mean, one thing that pops out is, you know, the scene where Jonathan first goes to Dracula's castle and they're having dinner late at night. And then Dracula's shadow is kind of moving independently from his body. But then he sees the picture of Mina and his shadow, the shadow of his hand kind of goes across the table and knocks over his ink quill. And it doesn't quite work in static images in the comic. I'm just looking at the page now. It's, you know, it doesn't quite connect in two images put together. You don't quite see that it's the shadow knocking over the inkwell as well as they set it up in the film.
Right. I know. I'm looking at it right now and I thought his hand like knocked over the inkwell, you know? So
yeah, exactly. It doesn't quite work. Mm-hmm. But having said that, in the following page, there's this wonderful image in one panel of Dracula's looking at Mina's photograph. Jonathan's kind of looking over his shoulder and saying, oh, that's my Mina. And then Dracula's shadow is just got these claws and talons, and the talons are reaching over to Jonathan. And then a few panels later, halfway down the page, Dracula's leaving him and saying, you're going to stay here, you know, as long as I need to. And he's leaving, but there's the shadow casts on Jonathan. It's this hulking black shadow of Dracula just enveloping and swallowing Jonathan. Mm-hmm. And we just kind of see little spots of light blue for his waistcoat and his face and his hands, but they're just being covered and swallowed up by Dracula's shadow. And, you know, I just love that we've got these great use of shadows. Just from my personal experience, I don't know if I told you this because I actually had to sign an NDA. I can talk about the project a bit without saying specifics, but I was hired by a company here in the UK, the Beano. They were adapting one of their comic strip characters into a TV show. And one of the things they wanted to do was do an 8-page adaptation of the pilot script to kind of give out to potential producers and TV show networks. And so they hired me and I brought in one of my artists to adapt part of the script. And there are so many considerations you have to think of, and you're constrained by the page size and the page format, but also the page numbers. We had only 8 pages. So we did have to condense things, cut things out. And also you kind of want to leave every page on a bit of a cliffhanger to keep the reader turning the page and reading forward when you're doing a comic. So, you know, changing and making sure, okay, well, if we have about six panels per page and we want this cliffhanger to come here, then we have to kind of move things around a bit or cut things out. And it's interesting going through this Dracula comic. There's a few times where we have kind of scene transitions on the same page. And, you know, generally you kind of want to avoid that unless you're maybe you're doing some cross-cutting between two different locations. But going from Dracula's castle to Mina sitting in her courtyard and talking to Lucy, you know, usually you would have those on different pages, but I'm sure just the page number and the constraints of having it to fit for this number of pages was a consideration. So there are things you have to do when you're moving from one medium to the next.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I, again, you know, like to bring in some stuff that we talked about with like Watchmen and how they fit dialogue into this frame, the cells. So how do you think they actually did that with like a film script, right? A film script is not adaptable that well to comics if, you know, you're not thinking about how much space the text is going to take and everything, right? So,
yeah. Yeah, and you know, not just dialogue, but certain action scenes, you know, take up more space than they would take up time in a film. And I've got this quote from, or not a quote, but Scott McCloud, who's written Making Comics and Understanding Comics. I couldn't find the direct quote. I was trying to find it. But he talks about how film gives the illusion of moving through space when only you're really moving through time, where comics give the illusion of moving through time when you're really only moving through space. Oh, so you're moving your eye across the page, but it's creating this sense of time passing in comics. Where in film, time is passing, but you're just sitting there and letting it kind of wash over you. And so it is, you know, time and physical space on the page. Those are the two considerations that you have to kind of push and pull when you're moving from one to the other, the two different mediums.
Yeah, I mean, there's this section where Jonathan is watching Dracula scale the side of the castle. And yeah. The way they drew it from, you know, Jonathan's point of view, it's pretty interesting. And they flipped the camera on him just to get that reaction shot, right? And
yes.
Like in the movie, it's a bit clunky looking, but here in the comic, it's much better. Jonathan's like reaction shot is like it's over this image of Dracula as he's scaling down the side of the castle.
Yeah.
So,
but that's interesting to me because, you know, in a film, if you and I were making that as a film, like, you know, we might show his face, he's looking at something, we show what he's looking at, and we show him reacting to it. But here, with this one kind of close-up of Jonathan's face kind of hovering above that sequence, you kind of, my eye kind of goes back and forth. So, you know, he's seeing these three things, you know, there's someone at the window, there's someone climbing out the window, someone climbing down, scaling down the wall, and then his face. But it, you know, that face does kind of reverberate back through that whole sequence, so we can imagine his face watching that whole sequence. So, you know, as much as it's moving forward, it's also that face is kind of, you know, backwards compatible almost, and, you know, is his face throughout that whole sequence probably. So instead of like cutting back and forth and showing multiple faces of Jonathan, we have this one face over the sequence that kind of tells us this is his reaction to this bizarre image of Dracula climbing, this old man climbing out his window and climbing down his castle. Parts for me where like it does fall apart a bit is when they try to replicate camera movement. So there's like the scene where Dracula is, or the sequence when Dracula's coming for Lucy for the one last time to finally drain her and turn her into a vampire. And in the film, it's kind of like this point of view shot, and you know, it's kind of moving through the grounds of the manor and like attacking different people and like jumping up on people, and the camera has become this attacker, you know, very much like those sequences in Evil Dead where the camera's just like running through the woods. And here in the comic, you know, point of view, and especially like moving point of view, doesn't quite work for me just because it's hard to kind of replicate that sort of sense of movement. And then the one thing that I really just kind of struggled with was early on, Jonathan goes to Mina to say, hey, I need to go away to Transylvania, I'll be back soon. Right. And then the, you know, quote unquote camera in the comic kind of moves and focuses on the peacock behind them and the blue of the peacock feather. And that transitions into the smoke coming out of the train engine that he's on in Transylvania. And it doesn't quite work that, again, we're trying to like have a camera in the comic that's moving and panning and dollying towards something. It just doesn't quite have that same effect. I know what they're trying to go for, but it just doesn't work for me.
Yeah, in the film, I'm not sure if they actually watched the film before they made the comic, but in the film, the peacock feathers, they cover Mina and Jonathan, and you, as an audience member, are left to assume that they, you know, it's something beyond a goodbye kiss for sure.
Which I've rewatched that. I was jumping around, but, you know, traditionally horror films have a very conservative point of view. And, you know, if you consummate before marriage, then that usually is a sign that something bad's going to happen to you. And both these characters go through tragedy. And Mina, you know, is kind of caught in this love triangle. So I definitely had that thought, like, oh, we're covering up because it's something that they shouldn't be doing in, you know, in this time period before they're married. Naughty, naughty.
Exactly. I mean, that was the whole point as well, right? With Lucy, and Lucy's very sexually active, let's say. And so
I think sex positive and very forward thinking, which at this, when the novel takes place, is, you know,
exactly
very brazen. And
And she pays the ultimate price for that, I guess, as well as the story progresses. The vampire myth itself is also kind of sexualized, isn't it? Like, it's basically all about sex. And I think they kind of lean into it in the movie and in the comic, in the story itself. It's like, you know, Jonathan has like a temptation when he's attacked by the female vampires. Vlad is trying to seduce Mina. That's his whole like story arc. And then there's Lucy, who is very sexually positive, and she also gets, you know, attacked by Vlad in the end.
I had, rereading it and looking at the story again, you know, I can't help but see connections to modern slasher films or slasher films of the 80s. And Lucy is very much sort of cannon fodder, you know, to buy time until we get to Dracula and Mina. You know, because he's really after Mina, because in this version or this interpretation of the story, he sees her as the reincarnation of Elisabetta, his wife from, you know, centuries ago, four centuries earlier, which is new. It's not from the actual novel. So the reincarnation angle is different from the novel, because I've read the novel as well. When I took my vampires in film and text course at the University of Victoria, it was very interesting. But Lucy is just sort of, yeah, like, we have to have another tragic death before we get to the main character we're very worried about. And it reminded me this time very much of slasher films where, you know, the final girl's friends all get kind of picked off before the final confrontation between the final girl and the slasher. In this case, you know, the final girl and the vampire. And I just feel like she's a bit underrepresented.
Definitely, but I think Lucy is to give an example of what Mina will eventually turn into in the story. And I think, just for, you know, people who don't have a source of reference maybe to what happens when someone turns into a vampire, obviously there's like a lot of exposition from many of the characters in the story about what will happen next.
Van Helsing is an exposition machine.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I guess it's just to show a visual example of what's going to happen to her, and then gives it people something to kind of worry about as far as Lucy's story arc is concerned.
For sure. I just felt that, you know, she exists to be, a warning to Mina. Which is unfortunate for her, the only other kind of main female character.
Exactly. So Lucy is actually Mina's sister, right? I was trying to figure that out. But they're
is
not.
She?
No, I don't.
I thought they were just very close friends.
That's what I assumed too, because I remember there was, like, at least in the film, the two characters kiss at one point when they were kind of maybe hypnotized by Dracula, or like in a, it's really hard to say actually if it's like a dream sequence or if it's like, actually real, but the two characters do kiss in the rain, right before, Dracula like hits the shores, like right when Lucy gets up and is like, oh, it's raining. And then they had this whole like sequence and I was like, oh, okay.
I don't think they are sisters, but, you know,
maybe they're just close friends.
No, I think they are just like very, very close friends.
Exactly.
I don't know. Because I'm just trying to flip through. I don't know if there's any.
When Lucy's in bed and she gives her ring to Mina as a wedding gift, I remember her saying something like, since we're sisters, or like, because we're...
I think very close friends.
Very close friends, for sure.
So the original novel is written in an epistolary form. And so it's written as a series of letters and diary entries and newspaper articles. And I like that this replicates that it, with the narration, is taken from Mina's journal or Jonathan's letters or Jonathan's journal. And it carries that through in the adaptation. I thought that was really kind of cool. And it had these little journal icons to tell us whose narration this is or whose journal this is. It kind of reminds me of, you know, in superhero comics where you've got like a little Iron Man faceplate to tell you, oh, this is Iron Man's dialogue or thoughts, or like Batman's got like the Bat logo before. So we've got Mina's blood red diary to tell us, oh, this is coming from Mina's diary.
Yeah, the diary of Mina. And it actually, she types up her diary, right? So that's like a brand new invention. And it, like, this story links the transition from more of a superstitious time to science, right? And that's like people moving away from handwritten notes and going into, you know, using typewriters, the cinemagraph, right? Or isn't that what it's called?
The scene where he goes and sees the early films. Yeah, of course.
Yes, exactly. So he's just like, he says it's like a wonder of science. A lot of like early science, like it's just, you know, evolving into something that is not superstitious at all, right? And Dracula is like the epitome of superstition.
Do you think, what do you think the idea is, that like, you know, you're foolish to hold on to these old beliefs? Or is the idea like, hey, don't think that your modern technology is going to save you from true evil?
I think that's the crux of the story, because magic is used several times, even towards the end when they're trying to defeat Dracula, right? Ancient evil never leaves. I think that's what the crux of the story is. And I mean, romantic side of the story as well. But although you can explain a lot of things with science, in the end, there's still some remaining essence of the old ways that are still kind of present in the world.
Maybe it harks back to that sort of conservatism, you know. Yes, we've got typewriters and cinemagraphs, but, you know, still stay chaste until you get married.
Exactly.
But one last thing I want to say about the writing before maybe we move on to the art and the drawing. But Roy Thomas, the writer, he actually adapted the Dracula novel. So with artist Dick Giordano for Marvel in 1975. So I think it's interesting that he's, you know, he's adapted the original novel, and now he's come back and adapted this film, which purported to be a very faithful adaptation of the novel. So I think it's kind of interesting that he's kind of done this story twice from two different perspectives.
That's really interesting. I guess they just thought that, hey, if this guy did it well the first time, I'm sure you can do it pretty well the second time, right?
Yeah, I just wonder, you know, how much of a conscious effort it was for him to not repeat himself, and to maybe they chose him because he would kind of hold on to the things that made the film unique from the novel, because he's already done the novel. So, you know, he wouldn't want to copy himself. But he also did the adaptation for the Star Wars comics, the original adaptation from film to comics, which I just thought was interesting that he's kind of the go-to adaptation guy.
Yeah. Wow. So these are the comics. Was it Marvel that put them out? The original Star Wars?
Originally
comics?
It was Marvel, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I thought that was just like kind of a cool thing that he's done, you know, these other very well-known adaptations. But let's talk about the art, man. What do you think? This is the reason that I said you had to read this, the reason that I said we should maybe think about doing this as an episode of the show. What do you think of the art?
The art is awesome. I loved the black and white stuff first before I actually read the color version. So the black and white art is much more gothic in nature to me. And it's just the fact that he loves to use blacks, and Mike Mignola loves to use blacks in his art, right? And so it's like the heavy blacks that
yes,
Mike Mignola likes to use in his art. And that really speaks to the story itself and the gothic nature of the story. So I loved his art. I think it,
yeah,
it, I mean, in black and white, it looks great. It fits the story perfectly. In color, it of course pops a little bit because they've added things like, you know, the color yellow, and the colors are also, I don't know, it doesn't look like, you know, super shaded and computerized. It's very like straightforward colors, like yellow,
they're blue. they're very flat colors, like solid blocks of color.
Exactly. And that also kind of, you know, is really cool. It's a very awesome way to highlight the art. They don't take away from the blacks at all.
No, and I think it's funny because, you know, the colors are so muted, and you know, there's very few colors on any given page. So I mean, it's not that far removed from black and white, and the colors definitely, I think, enhance the story. And it's interesting that you said, you know, you really like it in black and white, and obviously he does very much consider his solid areas of black. But I was just doing some research specifically on his style, and I was reading The Art of Hellboy, and they just talk about how his art style, either the background is mostly black, you know, with maybe just a little bit of color, and then the foreground is a little bit lighter, or, you know, if it's black and white only, the foreground is kind of white with a little bit of heavy blacks, or it's the opposite, and the background has a bit more white or color if it's a colored comic, and then the foreground is dark or mostly black. So I'm just flipping through these pages now, and either we've got like this side of light brown of all the characters in a room, but the characters are in dark, dark, heavy shadows and they pop from the background, or we've got, you know, very, very light characters, and then behind them is all very dark or very black, and then they pop. So just creating this harsh contrast, and, you know, really, I think solid black is very underutilized sometimes in comics, or just underappreciated. And when it's utilized well, you don't realize how important it is to solidifying the image.
Yeah.
And he, you know, and one of the reasons you want to do it is to guide the eye. And when we're reading comics and, or even looking at any kind of image, our eye is drawn to the area of the highest contrast. So if you've got dark characters in the foreground with a kind of lighter background, they're going to pop and your eye's going to go right there. Or if you've got a dark background with lighter characters, again, they will pop because that's the highest contrast. That's where your eye goes. And so I just think it speaks to the power of Mignola's art that it works in black and white and in color. But there's some interesting things just to speak specifically about color before we talk about, you know, his heavy use of solid areas of black, but just red. I love that he holds off on red, and he gives the note to the colorist to use red very, very sparingly. And, you know, they use it for the blood, especially that scene where Lucy comes back to life as a vampire. She's dressed in white. The rest of the page is mostly his heavy areas of black, but she's vomiting blood on Van Helsing and there's blood popping out. Or Mina's red journal pops out. It's the only red on the page. Or Mina's wearing a red dress when she's having these illicit meetings with Vlad. And because they hold off on red and really, really only use it very, very sparingly, when they do use it, it really just comes to life and jumps off the page and really grabs your attention. And I love that.
Yeah. I had no idea actually that, I mean, like maybe now I notice it when I look over the pages, that red only shows up when, you know, like certain characters get shot or if they get injured.
Or the evil eyes. But so as we said, this is right before Mignola created the character that made him famous and the character he's been focused on pretty much since then. Hellboy. But if you look at a page of a Hellboy comic, Hellboy is the only character who's allowed to be red.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll always find him on the page because everything else has these very kind of muted colors, very similar to this Dracula book. And then when you've got this just solid, full 100% red character, you'll always find him on the page and you'll always follow the main character. You'll never lose sight of your main character. And I just think that's really cool that even before he had this Hellboy character, he was doing that in his art, where he would hold off on that color red until it was crucially important, until he had a very good excuse to use it.
Yeah.
By Mark Chiarello, just to give credit again where credit's due.
Yeah. So with Mike Mignola's work, do you know if he kind of stuck to the horror genre afterwards or before that? Or what was his origins? Because I feel like he's kind of meant for that kind of work, especially with the heavy blacks that he uses and his art style?
Yeah. Well, so just doing a bit of research in anticipation of this discussion, you know, he was doing DC superheroes and he's done some Batman stuff. And one book that I'd recommend if you do like this art style is his Batman Gotham by Gaslight. And it's Batman versus Jack the Ripper in turn of the century Gotham. And it's very much him coming into this style. But it's just interesting that the book was, I think it was the Art of Hellboy, just talking about how he just didn't want to draw things that he didn't want to draw. So he would spend the time on drawing like these gothic, really cool, you know, Gotham City buildings. And, you know, if there was like a corner store or a mall, he just would try to avoid drawing it or just spend as little time as he could. And then it kind of came out, you know, this is the stuff that he likes to draw. He doesn't like to draw modern day cities and cars and superheroes. He likes to draw these big hulking monsters and, you know, these crumbling buildings. And I really enjoy that so much of this world in this Dracula book is cast in shadows. You know, he's really kind of coming into like, this is the kind of stuff that I like to do. And then since then, he's very much been the horror Hellboy guy. And the old ancient folklore guy with Hellboy. But, you know, he just kind of gives hints of the buildings, you know, large geometric shapes in black with, you know, a little bit of, you know, architecture sticking out in light, or just a little bit of light to show the brick, or the crumbling brick, just enough to kind of give a hint of where the location is. But otherwise, you know, it's kind of left to you to fill in the blanks or fill in that black shadow. And I just love that, because one of my favorite things about comics is how it invites you into the storytelling. And I think comics are unique in that way, that they don't work unless you are an active storyteller. You're an active part of the storytelling, you know. And the most specific example I'm thinking of is the transition from one panel to the next. You know, in your mind, you have to make sense, you know, okay, what's happened between these, you know, the space between the gutter. Have we moved in time? Have we moved in space? What's happened in between these? And you have to kind of fill in the blanks and kind of make it become a little bit of a film in your own mind. But he's doing that here with the architecture and the scenery. You know, he's only giving you a little bit of a hint, and it's up to you to kind of create the rest of the world. And I just love that. It's inviting to me as a reader. It's making me an active participant. And it's just, you know, you don't realize maybe sometimes how much work you're doing as a comic book reader. And I just love his art style is really much, really, really saying, okay, this is not going to work unless you're going to invest yourself and do half of the, or even more than half of the drawing really for me. You know, what else is missing? Fill it in with your own mind.
Yeah, that's something you and I have talked about before about the comic book genre, is that, yes, you're looking at the pictures, you're reading the words, but you're imagination is also kind of activated during that whole process. Mm-hmm. And so you kind of fill in the gaps with your imagination. Yeah, it's very different from watching a movie and being passive.
I think you're right. Passive is a great word when it comes to watching films. And, you know, you and I are, and I'm sure we're not the only ones, but we are a bit more active sometimes in watching films because we have that filmmaking background and we are kind of analyzing it a bit. But a film kind of just kind of happens to you. But I don't think people realize how much that you have to invest yourself into the comics.
Yeah, exactly. So you're basically an interactive participant in what you're consuming, right? And I wish that more people would read comics in that manner, and find books like this where it's obviously it's an adaptation, but it also has its like own style and narrative. It's so beautiful, and we said that like we like the comic book better than the movie, and it really is that, you know, when you look at it.
And I think it's funny you said that you wish people would read comics in that way, but I would argue that everyone is reading comics in that way. That just the mere act of you looking at one panel and then the next panel and creating meaning in the transition between those panels, you are reading comics in that way. It's just you don't realize it because hopefully you're entertained and you're having fun and your brain is doing all these, you know, all this, making all these connections without you realizing it. But I, you know, whether you do it to the extent that we're hoping people will after listening to this, but you're already there. You don't realize that you are already making those connections and building those panels to make meaning.
Yeah. And speaking of which, when I was reading John's dialogue, I was putting it in the voice of Keanu Reeves in his terrible British accent. I know he was trying. He was really trying. And I'm not sure why he got cast.
Man. Like, Keanu Reeves is beloved. I love Keanu Reeves. My wife Emma loves Keanu Reeves. We named one of our cats, or she named one of the cats before I even came along, after Neo from The Matrix. But he was miscast. This was a tough one.
It was a tough one. I feel like he gets better during the movie. Like in the beginning, is like trying really hard to, you know, be an Englishman, but like towards the end he gets a little bit better.
He's admitted that he was burnt out from several films in a row, and also Coppola was strongly encouraged to cast him because the studio wanted a heartthrob to bring in young girls to watch the film. So, you know, maybe it wasn't the best casting choice, but I still love Keanu Reeves, so I don't want to poo-poo him too much, but I know what you're saying.
I like his acting style. It's, you know, I don't want to say stilted, but his acting style is like, yeah, it's unique. It's, you know, the same thing like a Jeff Goldblum, right? Like mm-hmm. Jeff Goldblum acts a certain way and he's going to be Jeff Goldblum in every movie, right? So
yeah, and you just have to find those roles that, you know, that accent fit and support that character for sure.
And, you know, funny thing, you say that like Francis Ford Coppola was kind of forced to cast Keanu Reeves in this movie because to bring like young females to this movie, and I don't think that this movie is made for young females, so it's just kind of funny that the studio thought that was like, yeah, that's something we should totally do.
Well, I think the film really plays up the romance angle, whether or not you find this romantic, that, but as I said, you know, this, that romance angle was an interpretation or kind of given more prominence in this film and then subsequently this comic, that it doesn't exist in earlier adaptations. There's no real explanation for why Dracula sort of decides that Mina is going to be the target and the focus of his, you know, of all of his actions once he gets to England. And so they created this backstory where she's the reincarnation of Elisabetta. But, you know, I think even the tagline for the film is like, love never dies or love is eternal, something similar to that. So I think they were trying to make this into a romantic, and it's very sumptuous, and, you know, it is kind of hypersexualized in some scenes. So I think they were trying to push that angle. Whether or not it worked for you is up for debate, I guess.
Well,
not as much.
I'm not a young girl, so I can't quite say if I find it interesting or not. But yeah, I guess I could see that angle as, I don't know, maybe as from a romance angle, but who knows what the background is or the backstory of this whole project is, right? And what angle they were trying to go for. But I mean, vampires are sexual in nature, and it's just a whole allegory on sex in itself. So yeah, it kind of makes sense that they would try to market it to young women.
And I think since this movie's come out, you know, they're, you know, Twilight and Vampire Diaries is playing up that sort of angle of, you know, love is eternal and, you know, but also, you know, there is a reading that, you know, it's maybe a sexually transmitted disease, the blood of a vampire turning you into a vampire and you passing it along. And that sort of interpretation is, I think, very easy to see.
Dracula's dialogue from the movie is in Romanian, I'm guessing, but in the comic book, it is in English. And because, in the movie, I didn't know what he was saying, but thanks to the comic, I actually can make sense of it, you know?
Oh, your version didn't have subtitles.
No, it did not. Yeah.
Oh, I've always seen it with the subtitles.
No, I see. That makes much more sense.
It is accurate.
Because it's like, what is he saying? But yeah, I should just turn on the subtitles.
I want to talk about the art, just because I got so many notes again about, you know, just the solid use of these heavy black areas, these shadows, but it also, it creates depth. It creates, you know, it really creates form. And I've heard certain things from different artists saying, you know, without solid black, sometimes a page can really end up looking like an unfinished coloring book. And I just don't think people realize how much black is being used on a comic book page, even if it's in full color. And so I just invite people to take a look at comics as they're reading whatever next book or graphic novel they're going to pick up, and just take a look and just think, what would this look like without the color and how much black is actually being used on the page? And it really is a powerful tool for guiding your eye and kind of telling you where the most important elements of the page are and really kind of directing your reading experience. And, you know, like a really good page, you can almost squint and still kind of make out, you know, the flow of action and the movement from panel to panel and the placement of the characters just kind of based on these large areas of dark, dark black. And it's kind of a cool thing. Does the page still hold up with really only these solid black chunks in the page with nothing, with everything else removed? And specifically with Mignola's stuff, I love the collection that I had at the end has some original pencil pages. And if you look, you know, he's got some scenes from all the different issues, but Mignola has put these little X's all over the page. And do you know what those X's are for? Have you seen those before?
I've never seen those X's before, but I thought, yeah, it must be just for, you know, inking.
Yeah, it's to tell the inker, don't do any artwork here or line work because this is all going to be black. So, you know, rather than penciling in the shadows and coloring, it doesn't really matter because those pencils aren't going to be seen by anyone. The inker is going to come and go over that art anyway. So you'll just leave a little X to tell the inker, hey, when it's your turn to come and work on these pages, this is all going to be black. But if you just look at these pencil pages that Mignola has at the back of the book, there's just X's everywhere. And it's like half the page is just these floating X's, whether it's Jonathan Harker's hair or the background or the shadows or this very impressive scene where he is in the dungeon of Dracula's castle and Dracula emerges out of his coffin. And, you know, half of Dracula's body is in shadow. So that's all XXXXXXX. And then he's got, you know, one side of the coffin is coming out. He's got little X's everywhere. Jonathan is almost completely in shadow in silhouette with X's all over him. The page itself is covered in X's. And I just think it's crazy that so much of the page he knows is going to be this, is going to be black. And it's almost 50% or more sometimes on the pages. And it's just really funny looking at these pencils. You know, obviously he's done like the work underneath, but then when it gets time to, okay, I need to tell the inker how much to actually draw, but I'll leave the rest of this in black. And if you look at Mignola's work, the line work, he's got a very, very solid line. It's not a very dynamic line. So, you know, sometimes you look at brushwork of some inkers or some artists, you know, the line varies. So it goes from thick to thin kind of in one move, but his stuff is very, very steady and one kind of weight to the line, but then he makes that the dynamicism and he makes that form through those large geometric shapes of dark black.
Yeah, the last page with Mina and Dracul with Van Helsing is just completely like mostly black with a few lines here and there to kind of highlight the characters. And I found that was pretty interesting. It's kind of fits with like the thematic sense of the story and the darkness that the characters have kind of gone through.
Yeah, and it just pops out so much because, you know, that little bit of color, that little bit of light does now really, really, really come out of the page when it is, you know, set on top of this mostly black page. And yeah, there's so many images that just really do pop because it's just enough, just a bit of light hitting that character's face or just hitting, you know, Van Helsing's jacket, just enough to make him emerge from the shadows and emerge from the darkness. It really is just a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And if you haven't read it, you know, I really highly recommend the art. It's just sumptuous.
Yes. And have a peek at the covers themselves as well. The covers at the very end, they show like the behind the scenes kind of artist renders, I guess, of the originals. And they look so great. And I love this one last image of Dracula and Mina. You know, Dracula is in his kind of romantic guise as the prince. Mm-hmm.
With the top hat.
Yeah, with the top hat and everything. But behind him is like this werewolf beast, that he kind of turns into. And also like Mina as possibly a vampire. I'm not sure. But it's such a striking image. I would love this as like even a poster, you know, on my wall.
Just one last thing I want to say is if you are listening and you want more horror comics in your life, I have two collections of horror stories that I've written. I've drawn some of them, but I've also teamed up with a whole bunch of different artists. So if you go to my website, smithversussmith.com/store, you can get my collection, Gruesome Comics and Intergalactic Terror. It's two different books with 9 and 10 different short stories by different artists, different horror stories. I do have a vampire story in Gruesome Comics called Quick Bite. It's the story of a vampire who orders a pizza in order to feed on the pizza delivery boy. And I did take a lot of cues from Dracula, because he asks the pizza boy when he first shows up, and he says, "Do you enter freely and of your own will?" And the pizza delivery boy is just kind of like, "Well, I mean, you called us, so yeah." And I had the artist draw that particular vampire in the style of Nosferatu, which was the first adaptation of Dracula, this kind of unauthorized adaptation. That's kind of my favorite interpretation of Dracula. You and I were talking about that the other day. Just this kind of very monstrous, pointy nose, rat teeth, pointy ears. So if you're looking for more horror comics, and specifically vampire comics, go to smithvsmith.com/store and check out my Gruesome Comics collection. That's my little plug for the episode.
Great. And if you like vampire comics, well, I don't have any comics for you to read, but you can definitely let us know about what you think of this episode and suggest other books for us to read on Facebook and Instagram at Matt and Kale Read Comics, or Twitter at Matt and Kale Read. Thanks for joining us for this episode, and happy Halloween.
Thanks so much. We will see you for our next one. Happy reading.
Oh, it'll be a spooky one. Take care.
Our next book will be Arkham Asylum, A Serious House on Serious Earth, written by Grant Morrison and drawn by Dave McKean.